Thank you for listening to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I'm Kevin Estella. Just want to give a quick shout out to the Sig Sauer Academy and Sig Sauer. They're one of our sponsors here at Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. And Sig is one of those awesome companies that I've really enjoyed working with over the years. Even before I joined the ranks of the Fieldcraft Survival crew, I was going up to the Sig Sauer Academy back in 2015 and training up there. Guys, if you can't train with us at one of our locations, go up to New Hampshire, go meet the folks from the Sig Sauer Academy and train with them up there. There's a lot to do in the live free or die state. And I'll tell you, you can make a weekend out of it. So you show up the night before, you do your thing, go out to dinner, take the wife or the husband, whatever you got. And the next morning, go out, get a good breakfast, train, go to the experience center, get a good meal at Goody Cole's, go stay at the Exeter Inn, great place, and just really just enjoy that area. New Hampshire is one of the greatest states to train in, super friendly people, and I think you're really going to enjoy training at the Sig Academy. I've been there probably 24 times in my lifetime, and I've done everything from the pistol classes to the carbine classes, the defensive shotgun courses, and the precision rifle courses. Probably the most fun you're going to have there is bullets on vehicles, where you do a lot of ballistic training through glass and into vehicles. And probably one of the most important classes you will ever take is the 3-day precision rifle class, because it will make you a better shooter across every platform. Not to mention you get a chance to shoot out to 1,000 yards. Sig is really, really raising the bar, you can say that, with the experience center. I mean, they've got a museum there. They have an indoor shooting range. The pro shop is a place where you can spend a lot of money, so just be real careful. And while you're up there, look for, you know, some of my good buddies that are up there in the instructor cadre. If you see Cav, tell him that you got Cadbury eggs, and I'm sure he'll do all sorts of things for you, helping you out with, you know, your skill set on the range and all. So guys, please check out SigSauer.com, and please check out the Sig Sauer Academy. And by the way, that is how it's pronounced, Sig Sauer. It's not Sig Sauer. And I think you're going to have a great time.
Hey guys, are you thinking about getting a new truck cover? You should be considering Diamondback Automotive Accessories. Got Diamondback Covers is the truck covers that Fieldcraft Survival uses in all of our builds and open truck bed setups. Their 270, 180 can safely carry a dynamic load of 400 pounds, and the HD can safely carry a dynamic load of 1,600 pounds. In fact, I just got done talking to my marketing guy, and it looks like we're going to build a Ford Ranger Raptor with a new Diamondback cover setup. You guys can go to diamondbackcovers.com. And on top of it all, if you're thinking about security, please don't put a tarp on the back of your truck bed. Use something that has the security and allows you to lock up all your belongings with the low bearing capacity on top. That's what makes Diamondback covers the best. It's made in the U.S., ultra durable, theft protected, weather protected, and world-class customer service. Check them out at diamondbackcovers.com. Hey guys, Mike Glover, Wolf 21. I want to talk to you guys today about our mission statement, which is to provide natural supplementation and improve your health and well-being. Everything from CBD and CBN in combo to get a good night's rest, to RUCKUP for first responders who can't have anything with THC in it. We're always trying to innovate to provide natural supplementation, and that's our mission. We want to do what nobody else is doing and provide a full spectrum of options from Wolf 21. So go check it out. The link's down below, and I appreciate your business and appreciate your time. Thanks, guys. All right, welcome back. You're on the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast this time. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. So a lot of great feedback on your podcast on Mike Force. I think it's inspiring a lot of people. And I wanted to kind of focus on, we have a breakout podcast subject called Stories of Survival. And typically they deal with like natural or man-made disasters, like a situation that somebody was in. But certainly your situation is a story of survival, just in a different way. Mm-hmm. So let's start off with, if you haven't heard the Mike Force podcast, make sure you do that, but we'll give you a little bit of context. Let's start off with who you are and then kind of your summarized story as we discussed it on Mike Force.
Yeah. My name's Amanda. I am an ultra endurance athlete. And I guess the main story of how I got here today is I was diagnosed with two different cancers. I went through 16 months of chemo. I was told I would never run or hike again. And I went through all of my diagnosis while active duty Army. And it was a story of revival, of choosing whether or not to succumb to my diagnosis and succumb to being essentially a victim of my experience, or choosing the opposite and being a victor and choosing the warrior mindset and persevering through. So since my diagnosis, I've qualified for Ironman Kona, raced in Ironman Kona, and I'm now tackling Leadville 100, which you were so gracious to be able to fund my ventures to do so, which is a 100-mile ultramarathon in Leadville, Colorado.
That's amazing. Let's go back to talk about the moment that you got diagnosed. Kind of give us some lead up to that moment, and then let's talk specifically about the moment that you found out.
Yeah. So I was in the military, kind of deep in my career at this point. As we discussed on Mike Force, I was selected for Quick Start, which was a program that chose soldiers directly out of school to be selected for programs like JSOC. So I was at JSOC, had been, you know, ramping up my career, fully focused on that, went to airborne school, all the fun things that you get to experience as a soldier who gets selected for that program. And while I was going through my career and really persevering through it, my number one concern was staying healthy and not letting anyone know when I was sick or if I was sick. So when I realized that I had a tumor growing on my foot, my main concern was to not let anyone know about it specifically. And when I did let someone know about it, unfortunately, it was not received very well. When I went to the doctor at Big Army Doctor, I walked into his office, had him look at it after I was being begged to go have it seen by my husband. He said, "Get out of my office." Basically, looked at my foot, said, "It's nothing, get out of my office." And that moment was two things. For one, it was pretty alarming to just be kind of shooed out of someone's office. But for two, it was exactly the answer that I wanted to hear. So at the time, I had other plans of going to other programs and being selected for other programs, going to different schools and really accelerating my career. So when I had heard that it was exactly the thing that I wanted to hear, I was like, okay, whatever, sweet. But knowing in the back of my mind that it was probably a little bit more than that, than nothing.
When you actually were shooed out of the office, did he do so like in a playful way, a passive way, or was he like legitimately thought you were malingering and this was part of some kind of like deal for you to get out of something, which is, I assume that's what it was.
It almost felt as if he was like tired from his day, and it was almost like you're burdenous for coming in here. So I'm not sure which one it would have been. It was definitely not playful by any means. It was mostly like, okay, fine, take your shoe off, let me look at it. Ugh, it's nothing, just go away. So it was more so of like, I think, a lack of intentionality behind his, I guess, examination or lack thereof. And it was more so of like, you're kind of being a nuisance. So potentially, yeah, maybe he thought I was trying to get out of something, or I guess waste time, which was exactly the opposite of all of my approach in everything that I did in the military. Everything was very intentional and very, I guess, with integrity in mind.
So you fast forward, how long is it before you get back into the doctor's office? Because I know there's a story there where your husband actually said something and got it handled, right?
Yeah. I believe it was around a year later. So I went back to my life and my career, and it was about a year later. I went into the dermatologist with my husband for my husband. He's a moly guy. He gets moles removed all the time. Just, I guess, a backstory of melanoma and skin cancers. Most of them are caught at very, very early stages, even pre-cancer. So if you get regular dermatology checkups, more than likely you will catch something before it becomes anything. So he gets regular checkups. His grandpa died from melanoma. So he had me come along with him. And I didn't necessarily know if this was his plan altogether, but when he had his mole removed, I went to the appointment and he told the dermatologist, "Hey, like, please look at her foot before we leave." So this is about a year later. She looked at it and she looked at me and she was like, I could tell by her face that she was shocked and concerned. And she was like, Amanda, you need to go get this looked at. And right then and there, I kind of knew. I was like, okay, well, maybe like this small back of my mind, I knew that something was wrong. This completely validated that. And so I went back to group PA and then had a referral to Big Army Doctor, dermatologist. And when I walked in his office, this was, like I said, a year later, he said the same thing that the female dermatologist said, civilian dermatologist said. She said, or he said, Amanda, I cannot believe that anyone let you out of their office with this.
Was it group? Fast forward the first time that you were looked at, was it a group PA?
No.
Or was it the like clinic?
It was the clinic.
Yeah. Okay. So it's like the local clinic for designated units.
Yes.
To specifically go to, which is typically a PA, right? He would have been a PA, or was he a doc?
I wouldn't be able to tell you.
So then the referral you got was bypassing that clinic.
Yes.
To a higher level of care, which happened to be the Big Army Hospital with the doctor.
Dermatologist, yeah.
Dermatologist. Oh, so you got a referral for a dermatologist.
Yes. When after not getting the referral the first time, I kind of reassessed the situation of like, I should have demanded a referral to a dermatologist, because your average group PA isn't going to know, or not group PA, any PA isn't going to be able to just like look at your foot and immediately know, right? We have specialists for this. Specifically, dermatologists are the ones who are fully educated on identifying cancer in the skin.
He says, we definitely get this checked out. What does that mean for people who are unfamiliar with this kind of cancer? How do you process it? What do you do next?
Yeah. So the first step is always a biopsy. So they do a regular skin check, which usually, even if you went in just to get a regular annual checkup, they would have you take your clothes off. They would completely look at every little potential spot on your body with a microscope, with certain measurements in mind, coloring in mind, et cetera. If they find something that looks a little funky, to put it lightly, they will take a scalpel to it and remove it. So do a small biopsy. If that small biopsy comes back in any sort of abnormality, there's a range of abnormality, they will go in and take out more additional skin around the border, and that will be sent for biopsy as well. So to identify if potentially the cells have traveled outside of that original border. Once again, not necessarily even cancer, doesn't necessarily have to be cancer to be removed. It could just be, as I call, funky cells, abnormal cells.
Because melanoma, it starts on the surface of the skin and then it spreads to adjoining parts of the body.
Mm-hmm.
I assume it does, what are they called?
Metastasizes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you get the biopsy.
Yes.
And then that takes a period of time to come back.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't know. I'm not sure why it took so long, but I didn't hear from the initial biopsy for 3-4 months. So my thought process was no news, good news, right? That's what everyone's told anytime they go to the doctor.
Yeah.
So I didn't hear anything. I heard from him maybe once or twice checking in, just saying, hey, we haven't heard anything yet. So nothing yet. And then, like I said, in the third, fourth month, I already kind of forgot about it. It was mostly like, okay, well, if I haven't heard anything, it's probably nothing. Which I'm not sure what was going on during that time period. Only the doc or dermatologist would know about that. Supposedly they sent it off to the Mayo Clinic and they sent it off to different locations to be looked at closer. But after 3-4 months, I heard back. I actually received a voicemail from the dermatologist, and he just said, because they're not allowed to give diagnoses over the phone, you have to be seen in person. He just said, Amanda, this is really concerning. I need you to come in basically immediately.
And you knew?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, you would think out of all the healthcare systems and the hierarchy of priorities amongst populations, that our service members would be the number one priority in readiness, because they would call it readiness.
Yeah.
So if you're laying stagnant because you're waiting on a result,
mm-hmm.
you're not ready.
Mm-mm.
And so the number one priority across med pros and all these systems is like, keeping soldiers ready for conflict. Mm-hmm. And they obviously didn't take that serious, or there was some hiccup along the way, which is mainly the entire system. So, okay, let's take it to the moment that you get that notification. What is the time from the notification of the voice message and then the time that you got in physically to see the doctor? Was there a period of time?
It was about 30 days.
Wait, 30 days from the them telling you need to get in here?
Them telling me we need to do surgery to them doing surgery.
30 days.
It was maybe even longer than 30 days.
Okay, and the biggest concern with cancer is cancer obviously spreads with time. Mm-hmm. It's a simple math problem, and the more time that goes by, the more likely or probability of you getting more infected in throughout your body, right? Mm-hmm. Did you have a concern from the initial diagnosis of cancer in that 30-day period? Were you freaking out? Like, what was your mindset? Like, were you doing workouts still? Were you just crippled, like not able to do things? Like, what was your mindset?
It's actually really funny because we actually did a pre-deployment, basically training session in Louisiana for 3 weeks. So for three of the 4 weeks, I was in Louisiana.
And they made you do a pre-deployment train up?
You know what's funny is I didn't even get clearance to come home early to get surgery.
You're diagnosed with cancer. Yeah. You have a surgery to get for that cancer that's on your foot. Mm-hmm. And they told you that you have to go to a pre-deployment train up?
Yeah, I was in charge of my section at the time, and my whole job was to get soldiers spun up to be able to deploy properly. So they, you know, that was their priority at the time.
And was this in first group? Uh-huh. What battalion? First group?
I'm not going to say.
You should say. Wow, that's horrible.
Yeah, I was at MICO.
Okay.
MICO GSP.
And then, so after they kind of, they get you down or CONUS and you're doing a train up, what's the hiccup with them trying to get you back for surgery? What happened?
I asked to get clearance to come back early to prep for surgery, to get surgery, but
where are you training at? Where's the off-site training site?
It was Louisiana.
So you're in JRTC, and they can't release you early from JRTC to go home to get prepped for surgery? Mm-mm. So how many days did you have in preparation?
It was one day. I got back from JRTC, and then I went into surgery. I know I'm laughing because it's just
did they ever make? Did you ever make an IG complaint? Probably not.
No.
This is Japanese in you.
Yeah.
You realize, you know, so I had a sniper on my team. And he was a Marine Corps sniper. He was shot in combat in Iraq as a Marine Corps sniper. He was saved by an 18 Delta. Mm-hmm. So a Special Forces medic saved his life. Then he went SF. Mm-hmm. So fast forward, he does team time. He goes to sniper school, Sephardic, Halo, and then he gets assigned to my team. He gets screened in a chest x-ray for cancer or for the issues he had in his chest. And it was riddled with cancer. And any decently trained human being, radiologist who saw that would have detected that because there's many abnormalities on the imaging of the CT scan he got. And so fast forward, he goes in because he's like critically ill and gets a diagnosis of stage 4 cancer, lung cancer. They go back to the CT scan and the original CT scan had the cancer and it became and was basically pushed out of the room. He put forward legislation. Mm-hmm. It's Stay School was his name, Rich Stay School. He was one of my 18 Bravos. As he went through this legislation, he got it to where if you're a service member and you're treated in malpractice, you could sue the Army or the military. Oh. And I don't know if that's still an option, but I would just advise as a former SS Sergeant Major and seeing these kind of things, mm-hmm. that's unsatisfactory, should not happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, there should have been an IG complaint. There should have been a whole bunch of protocols, at least a JAG intervention. But none of that was done because you're humble. You don't want to rock the boat. You disconnect. You could still sue that doctor. And even if it's a case of litigation that lines out the issue, it potentially could deter or prevent a further malpractice. Because I've been malpracticed in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and almost died. I mean, they left a surgical sponge in my gut after they hacked me like I was a piece of meat. But I was in PLDC, which is WLC now, in 2000, and got all these things lined out, got surgery, left the gauze in me, had a fever, spent more time in the hospital than I should. Then I had an abdominal obstruction. That doctor, from what I heard, because I investigated it later when I went into SF, should have never been practicing medicine. I mean, there's a lot of good Army doctors, but there's also a lot of poor Army doctors that are not good.
One of the things that I can't get out of my brain when I think of Army docs versus civilian docs is the desire to grow business or to attain business or to maintain business, right? In the civilian world, you have to be a good doctor to some extent to be able to receive clients, to be able to maintain clients, and to be able to receive an income. In the Army, you don't have that,
no standard,
right? Because they have clients that are gifted to them. They don't have to work to maintain. So I think that's where some level, I think, of maybe like lower quality doctors. Like you said, there's definitely some incredible doctors who are in the military. Don't want to discount those. However, I do think that there is some level of that that's lacking in order to keep doctors in check and balanced out.
Yeah, and the general malpractice of doctors and their incompetence is partly built into the culture of them dealing with malingerers constantly, like people who are constantly looking for ways to get out of things. Mm-hmm. But I always saw this as a demand signal. When you have more elite people, because they're serving in special operations, they're doing so voluntarily. Mm-hmm. And so in that voluntary status, they're just more likely to be the right people. Mm-hmm. And they also are exposed to more issues, including medical treatment and intervention, than most soldiers, because their job's more dangerous. Mm-hmm. So why would you not do that? I mean, when I was in USASOC, compared to USAFIC, Special Forces Command, USASOC's was tier one medicine. Mm-hmm. You had a doctor at your disposal, mm-hmm. and they handled business because they knew you weren't in there malingering or trying to get out of work because you enjoyed what you did for a living, mm-hmm. and you wanted to get back in the fight. Mm-hmm. So their job was to fix you, and they're the best doctors, and most of them were JSOC docs that I worked with. And so you get to this and you get the surgery, and then what happens post-surgery?
Yeah, so I had, I think it was somewhere around 100 stitches in my body after surgery. So I had the top of my foot, a portion of the top of my foot removed, portion of my ankle removed. So that's all the fat, all the ligaments, all everything that could have been impacted by cancer. And then I also had...
Ligaments? They're removing ligaments?
I don't, that's what they told me. So that's why it took so long to recover afterwards. So anything that could have been impacted by cancer, they have to remove.
And they're drilling down into that? Like a mastectomy,
all the soft
tissue.
All the soft tissue. So in addition to my foot, they also found cancer in my groin area. So they removed lymph nodes in my groin. So it was just, I mean, they had two different surgeons in surgery with me as well as resident surgeons. So it was I think it was like 6 hours or 8 hours.
The lymph nodes adjoining your groin, they removed those?
Yeah. So cancer, what metastasis means outside of stage 1, stage 2 is it travels specifically for melanoma. It's in your lymphatic system, which your lymph nodes, your lymphatic system is what controls your immune system. So you have channels of lymph nodes that run from the top of your head to the tips of your toes. So they found cancer in my lymph nodes, in my groin. And they removed those. And stage 3 to stage 4, the difference between that is once it travels outside of your lymphatic system and finds an additional organ, usually with melanoma, it's lungs and brain, that is considered stage 4.
So post-surgery, they do an assessment. How long after do they do the assessment?
assessment of the
cancer to see if it's still in you.
So I was referred to right after my surgery. My surgery was done in Big Army. I was referred to Seattle Cancer Care Alliance in Seattle. They were the ones who gave me all the trial chemo, all of that. They maintained coverage of CT scans and blood draws and all the things that go into cancer treatment, I guess, or prevention. Seattle Cancer Care Alliance handled.
What's the status of the military at this point? Were they making you come to work, or did they say, hey, you handle you, you got cancer? Like,
It was during COVID lockdowns in Washington State. So it was up until the actual base closed down, I was going to work every single day. So
post your surgery?
Definitely post. I was going to trainings post surgery in my boot.
How long after surgery did you go back to work?
They gave me 2 weeks because I was on bed rest for one whole week. I was not allowed to move.
So then they gave you an additional week?
Yes.
And then they made you go back to work?
Yes.
And return to duty, like RTD?
Oh, like sweeping the floor. Yeah. Not that that was my job by any means, but yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And it was so strange. No remorse when I came back, other than like close friends that I had at the time.
Nobody in your chain of command? No NCIC, no first sergeant in GSB, no sergeant major? Mm-mm. Did they even ask you, like, hey, how are you?
Commander at the time and first sergeant brought me into their office, asked what their process should be according to my diagnosis. And they were working with the group PA to figure out what I should be required to do.
It should be required you do nothing. You have cancer.
Yeah, yeah.
The number one priority from a leadership perspective as a senior enlisted advisor or a commander is to cater to the care of the soldier in every way possible. So there's not a return to duty. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the protocol by USASOC doctrine. Mm-hmm. Like, it's you take care of the soldier first and you don't make them go back to work. Like, that shit makes me sick.
Yeah.
Oh my God, dude.
I was sent a video actually, because we clean the office every Friday, deep clean. I've sent a video from a war officer that I worked with recently. He said, I hope you don't miss this. And it was me in my boot sweeping the floors.
And you just had cancer removed out of your body.
Yeah.
And you had cancer still in your body, right?
Still in body, yeah.
So how much chemotherapy did you have to do post? Wait, you're in the middle of a chemo treatment while you're doing these things?
Oh, I was in meetings. I was, yeah.
Oh, great.
So my immune system also during COVID, it was kind of a strange time to be going through all this for sure.
How long is the treatment for cancer post the surgery? And then when do you get a good diagnosis?
So recovery for after my surgery was 6 months of no weight bearing exercises, no weight bearing in general. So I was on crutches in a boot for 6 months. I was on bed rest for 1 month for 1 week post surgery. And then I actually was at training in Florida when I was released to be able to take my boot off and start walking. So this was 6 months later. So I would train my foot to be able to just enjoy walking on its own with no boot or anything like that. And then I started my chemotherapy. So I got surgery in March or April. And then I started chemo in September because they needed my body to be semi-fully recovered from my surgery in order to start chemo. And I started chemo with Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. I did 14 months of trial chemo with Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. And then additionally, because I was diagnosed with a secondary cancer, I had to be treated for 3 months for that cancer.
Hey, how's it, everyone? Nate here with the show's sponsor for today. This week is Oakley Standard Issue. And what's awesome about this week is Oakley Standard Issue is having their Member Appreciation Week, which means between March 14th and the 24th, a whole big whopping 10 days, you get 55% off. 55% off if you use the code FIELDCRAFT24. So head on over, try to snag some of their Flight Deck M snow goggles before they're gone. That way you can try to hit the slopes with some cool stuff before it's over. Head on over, check out their ballistic mil-spec eyewear, their gloves, footwear, bags, prescription glasses, or of course, just sunglasses if you feel like looking cool. So again, that is 55% off between March 14th and 24th. whole big 10 days if you use the code FIELDCRAFT24. Head on over to Oakley Standard Issue and check it out.
14 months.
Yeah.
Like in September to 14 months later. That's how long you did it?
Yes.
So like, were you scared to die? Like, is this something that's going through your head? Like, are you like making peace with this potential? Because cancer is the scariest thing on the planet, mm-hmm. right? Because it's an unknown like entity that exists, and you hear about people dying and you think it never happens to you. Mm-hmm. And then next thing you know, you're diagnosed and you're living through it, mm-hmm. and you're going into a hospital, you're getting chemotherapy. Was there like a realization like, hey, I better get my stuff squared away because I might die?
Yeah. There was so many waves throughout that process, and chemo was a great opportunity for me to actually take a step back and ask myself those questions. I feel like especially soldiers in the military, we're so go, go, go all the time. We don't even ever ask ourselves if we're okay. And this was my opportunity to do so. So I went through a few months of asking myself these questions regularly. However, it was never being necessarily scared. I'm not sure if that was delusion or if it was denial or if it was the way that I was raised. But I had always viewed it as a challenge, and me realizing that everything is going to be the way that it is going to be. And I have the opportunity to choose how to respond to it. So I did ask myself, I was scared. I still am. I would say I still have fears of dying. However, I know that everything happens for a reason, and I know that I can only do with what I have right now, and there's no sense in being anxious about what could happen when I'm blessed with today. And that's truthfully, like, the way that I approached all through my chemo was realizing that every day is so, so beautiful and such a blessing, and what can I do within these 24 hours that I'm gifted that is going to make today great? And it really just, it taught me to be intentional with my time. And that's why I say that cancer was a blessing in my life, not necessarily something that I would wish for anyone in my life, but it taught me how to be intentional and to really key in on like what was really important today, what is really important today, what energy I allow into my life, what people, who's in my inner circle, what's important, and what I do with my life. Because when we're go, go, go all the time and we are distracted on a daily basis, we forget about the big picture of what life is really about.
Were you living unintentional and kind of complacent prior to that?
100%.
Yeah.
I think it was all about my career, right? It was very selfish. It was, I need to be the best that I could be within my career and service, of course, but it was, how can I be like better and go, go, go all the time and improve. It was never about how I can help, truly help others and what my life was placed here on this earth to do.
Well, what do you think that vision or that mission is now? What has it changed in the mission statement for your life?
100%. I believe that I was gifted this experience to be able to show others how capable they are, to show others that there's more to life than a death sentence that you're gifted by a doctor, and that it's really important to seek discomfort outside of your life. Because for me, discomfort is what created intentionality. It's what's created this vibrant and authentic life that I have now. It's because I've gone through difficult things and I still seek discomfort now. I don't sit in my distracted life just comfortable every single day. I seek that because I know that teaches us so many different lessons in our lives. It teaches us how to grow, how to impact others. And instead of kind of succumbing to this like weird world bubble that we've placed ourselves in, that we could just be distracted all the time, doing hard things is what creates intentionality and growth.
Do you, or did you, I know you do now, but did you look into optimizing your health and your wellness holistically? And I see you use those tactics today, but did that journey start for you then?
No, unfortunately, my cancer diagnosis and treatment really caused me and my husband specifically to look at the healthcare system as a whole and realize that there's so many missing pieces to the puzzle. Specifically, my oncologist at Seattle Cancer Care, I asked him if there was anything that I could do to help me through chemo or help me through my cancer journey in general. And he literally said, no, like NO.
Which is a false, right?
Nothing I could
There's a diet protocol.
Drink
a
more water.
Protocol. Yeah.
Yeah.
Something, because all of that helps.
100%. And there's science now that says that high.
What a real piece of shit. You should find that dude and just beat his ass in the parking lot.
It's a.
Sorry. I don't know if we could have that in there. You might want to edit that, Yoshi.
That might be actionable.
God, what a. Okay.
Yeah.
So you had to do that journey on your own.
Yes.
What are some of the protocols that you did early on, or if any? And then let's talk about some of the protocols you do now.
Yes. I mean, it started with meditation in the mountains. I called it my mountain meditation. I would just hike every single day with my dog and just spend that time in the mountains. Have you heard of the Japanese concept misogi?
Mm-hmm.
I actually just stumbled upon this recently. But misogi teaches us to do hard things, push this envelope of can I do this? I don't know if I can do this. And maybe it's just kind of teetering on this line of like, can I do this? Can I not do this? It's doing something extremely hard in that realm, but being outdoors. Mm. So I, without even knowing this concept, I dove into that right away because it was the only place where I found peace and solace and could actually think about my life in a constructive and realistic way. So I started with that, and that was one of the main protocols. And Japanese culture also teaches us about forest bathing. That's another thing that that I did without even knowing that I did. I did that. I started looking into IV therapies. That's something that I take into my life right now because IV vitamins are so much more bioavailable to our bodies. I have now looked into high dose vitamin C, which has a ton of evidence to support cancer patients and also help fight cancer as well. These are units as high as like 50 grams of vitamin C. In addition to that, I'm just always open. I think that what's different about Western medicine and my approach is Western medicine thinks it has all of the great and grand ideas. Versus my approach is I'm open to whatever as long as it feels right to me and my body and has good evidence and support behind it as well. I think also diet, exercise, water, sauna, cold plunge, all of these things can help us because reducing any sort of inflammation also helps us as well.
Have you gotten tested like blood work wise as a protocol? And how often do you do that?
Yes, I do get blood tested through hormone doctors specifically. I, unfortunately, at Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, was not told that my chemo would impact my fertility. So in this process of trying to figure out if I will be able to conceive children naturally, I've done that in support of that as well.
So that's something you're working through now?
Working through now. Every quarter I get blood tested.
Okay. So that leads me into the next question, which is when I think about life and my focus and this journey and all the things that I do, most significantly right now, I do it for my children. And, you know, me and their mother aren't close, but we're cordial and polite. But that those kids are my number one focus because raising them has given me a new purpose. And it's just, I strive to be a really good dad and focus my time and attention on them. I imagine in this situation with all of these things, having babies, raising a family is something that you desire. Is that a potential chance now with the care that you're getting outside of the military?
I'm working on it. I'm not sure. We won't know until we know. Yeah, I've always wanted that as well. Me and my husband are very much willing to do anything, including IVF or other treatments to be able to do that when the time is right for us. So I was being treated with progesterone, just cyclical progesterone. It's actually a hormone that everyone has, even males have. But it's the sole hormone for reproduction in the female body. Obviously, there's balances of testosterone and estrogen as well, but progesterone is what allows your body to be able to ovulate. And that's what I was in like dumpster numbers post-chemo. So I was doing that
as a trial, right? It wasn't even a protocol, it was a experiment.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Is that normal as an experiment?
Yeah, they... I have to be careful with the way that I say this, but it's not common knowledge that when you're receiving chemo from a institution that is a research-based institution, that you are a trial, like you are being trialed on. You are the guinea monkey pig. That these treatments are being trialed for. In addition to that, my secondary cancer, my autoimmune disease, I was covered in open wounds from head to toe in my mouth. And my secondary cancer, which started in my eye, I went to my oncologist at Seattle Cancer Care Alliance and said, these are side effects of this drug. I never had this issue before. I've gone through 14 months of it. And this is a month later. My body is telling me that this is poisonous to me. He said, it has nothing to do with this. It can't be that. So trial drugs, but not actually giving or collecting data that you're getting from patients.
It has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I was like, I didn't have this before.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty, if you look at experimentation and control groups, it's like, if it wasn't there before and now it's there, there's some cause and effect.
Well, and your skin too is your biggest organ. So your skin is going to tell you.
It's purging that poison.
Exactly. It's saying, this is too toxic. Let me get it out of my body. How am I going to do that? I'm going to open up these wounds all over your body and try and push it out.
God, this cancer system sounds like a disaster.
It's an absolute disaster.
Is this what everybody's dealing with?
I think so. The more people I talk to about this, especially when it comes to chemo, surgery is different. I guess like preventative medicine may be different because they're not getting money from it, but there's some corruption that has to happen when you're treating patients with something that's going to make you wealthy, right? And we've seen now Pfizer's come out with this cancer drug that they advertised during the Super Bowl. And I'm worried about seeing that now. Like, it just advertising these huge money-making drugs to be able to treat something that so many people get is dangerous. It's super dangerous.
Good God. Because, a lot of us, you know, been exposed to trash pits and all the things, worry about the detection of cancer.
Yes.
Because that's like, you got to detect it. Mm-hmm. But then if you detect it and then you get in the treatment, you're still going to war. It's still like a different, it's just a different battle.
Different battle.
Oh God. All right. Let's talk about your 100-mile race.
Okay.
I mean, I ran a 50-miler and that almost killed me. But I do enjoy like the endurance aspect of all the things because there's a protocol, right? There's like, and it's not the same protocol that you would follow for short-term races. You can get it out. We're at that.
Sorry.
Get it. Get it, girl.
Totally just choked on the water.
Yeah. We're closing out. This is the last question. There's so much Japanese in this room right now.
Oh
Yoshi,
my gosh, yes.
You, Kimiko. I got the least 13%.
Oh no!
This allows me to hang out with you guys. All right, so you're going to do a 100-miler.
Yes.
And I've done a 50-miler, and what I realized in training for a 50-miler is it's a very different protocol than you would imagine. Like, there's a protocol where if you run too fast or your heart rate gets too high, it could bonk your entire chances of finishing 100 because you're in a different cardiovascular system or subset of your system. And I imagine that this is something that's consuming. I mean, you have to be fully committed because you have to be prepared. And if you're not prepared, failing a 100 is going to suck really bad.
Yes.
So what are some of the things that you're preparing for this 100-miler?
Yes, I'm actually 11 days out from my first ever 50.
You're 11 days out?
From my first ever 50. So you have to give me all the tips or the not tips.
Oh my gosh.
The anti-tips. So I'm doing 2 50-milers leading up to this 100-miler because I would like to feel what it feels like to be in that suck zone. And I'm doing this 50-miler not extremely prepared because I want to feel that.
You're going to feel it.
Oh, I want to. I'm excited about it. Maybe there's a little masochistic, I guess, viewpoint of that. But I've been lifting. So I think this is one of the coolest things about ultramarathons is the importance of strength long term in these ultramarathons is there.
Yeah.
So there's no formula yet. Ultra is still very new. Hasn't been around for 100 years. There's no solve yet to running 100 miles. And I don't know that there ever will be because running 100 miles has so many other factors that goes into it: nutrition, hydration, how you prepped for it, the week before you prepped for it, your mindset. And your mindset, I've heard, after 50 miles is the only thing that gets you through. So I think there's different layers of how I'm preparing. For one, it's strength training. For two, it's running, zone two. For three, it's adding in speed work, hill work, elevation, all of those different factors, because Leadville starts at 10,500. And then in addition to that, it's mindset training. So learning how to push through when things suck.
Yeah, it's gonna suck.
Oh yeah.
I think at mile 40 for me, and I did it solo because my race in Arizona got canceled because of COVID.
Oh, okay.
And so I just documented it and just did it by myself and ran and didn't have support. But the last 10 miles were really brutal because of my legs and knees. I didn't realize the impact of running in zone two for that period of time, the effect it would have. Mm. And you wanted to stride just to break out the monotony and stretch the legs, but that's detrimental to the endurance long-term. Mm-hmm. I also didn't have a as optimized nutrition plan as I should have. Mm-hmm. I should have ate more food instead of just so much glycogen.
Oh yeah.
Because that glycogen over a 12 or 18 mile ruck at 2 hours or 3 hours, which is my normal ruck time for 12 and 18 miles, when I converted that to a run that lasted 8+ hours, that changed everything, because you can't eat that much glycogen because your body will purge it. Your systems just get all out of whack. So I can't imagine, man. And then the elevation change, you're right. What's cool is, like, you're super fit, you're super strong. A lot of people who are marathon runners or even, you know, 5K, 10K kind of sprinters, they don't carry a lot of muscle because they want to just be able to move and go. But at some point, it's like there's a balance shift.
Totally.
And it's like you need that muscle to get uphill or even to get downhill and changes the elevation. And I like how Leadville is a race of ups and downs, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you know the elevation gains and losses?
15,000, I believe.
Huge.
Mm-hmm.
When are you running the Leadville race?
August.
Yeah. And we opted to support you. We'll bring the sprinter van out there. Or you could use a sprinter van, and then we'll bring people out there to support you. But this is going to be what's the point of this 100? Is it the train up and the journey and educating people, and you do that through some kind of content segment? Like, what's how do you share that?
Yeah, so there's going to be a documentary that's being filmed on this journey. And it was kind of my next thing to decide or to show other people how capable we all are. You know, not being told I would ever run again or hike again, and then being able to do a 100-mile race like Leadville, I mean, that in itself is a statement that will hopefully help inspire other people and show people that maybe what they think that they're capable of is significantly less than what they actually are. In addition to that, being able to do something really hard and race 100 miles in addition to supporting a cancer charity like First Ascents is exactly in line with my mission. So First Ascents is a cancer organization that is dedicated to providing outdoor experiences to cancer patients and survivors, and also MS patients and survivors. So they put on these nice retreats to be able to teach these people and these athletes how to do the sport that they want to learn. It could be White River rafting. They have some hiking. They have rock climbing, actually, in Utah. So it'll be so incredible. And just having that be my why, I think, is going to be able to project me for forth to the finish line in itself.
You should do the me and a famous explorer are doing a huge thing. I don't even know what it's called. What is it called? What the hell is that called when you do like an exploration thing?
Expedition.
Dude, that's your God. We're doing.
There's the Korean coming out.
It is. Oh.
I'm just kidding. I love Koreans.
Well, Japanese often love Koreans. They love us real, like, long time.
We love you long time. Yoshi's cringing over there.
This expedition. For Wolf 21, we're doing a Wolf 21 expedition. You should come with us.
I would love to. Where are you going?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I have no other information besides that.
Okay, I'm in.
but this guy does epic expeditions.
Oh, okay.
Ben Lights actually connected us.
Oh,
and
awesome.
We're doing a Wolf 21 expedition, but it will include like pulling a snow sleds. Ooh. It's probably going to be in Norway somewhere in that area.
Awesome.
But it's pretty exciting because it's this route that few have done that includes a lot of treacherous terrain, but nothing crazy. Like we won't be climbing. We'll just doing a lot of hiking, a lot of pulling sleds, and it's all self-supported. So me, you, and him will all self-support ourselves.
Glaciated?
What is that?
Is it glaciated?
What the hell does that mean?
my mountaineering is coming out. It's like—
Is it on a glacier?
Yeah.
Like part of it? It is.
So you have to cross crevasses, be roped up to each other. Yep. Okay.
And it's a Wolf 21 expedition, so it'd be perfect.
I love that.
It'd be perfect.
Super in.
How can people find you and what you're doing?
They can find me on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, all just Miss Amanda.
Oh, you did YouTube?
I did. I took your advice.
I gotta plug it. I gotta make sure we put the links down.
Yeah,
below.
We're still new. We're still new and ramping up, but I'm doing it.
It's a crazy world.
It is a crazy world.
I like YouTube the best though.
Yeah.
YouTube's the funnest. All right, Amanda, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Yep.